people who goes off into his ivory tower and writes his 15th symphony, and that's it. You know, I think there's more that we have to do as musicians.
Under the direction of Gunther Schuller, the New England Ragtime Ensemble recorded an album called Scott Joplin, The Redback Book. This album received the Grammy Award from the National Academy of Recording Arts for the best chamber music performance of 1973. As the ragtime revival gained momentum in the United States, the New England Ragtime Ensemble became more popular, making appearances at Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, and the White House. But the Ragtime Ensemble is just one of Gunther Schuller's many accomplishments. I'm Eleanor Stout.
And I'm Robert J. Lertzema, and this is Pantechnicon, your weekly magazine on entertainment and the arts, brought to you also on weeknights at 6:15 under the partial support of the Massachusetts Council on the Arts and Humanities. Gunther Schuller's involvement in music has many facets. He's a musician himself, a conductor, a composer, and he's president of the New England Conservatory of Music. Gunther grew up surrounded by music. His father was a violinist in the New York Philharmonic. Gunther began playing the French horn professionally when he was 16, including the American premiere of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony with the New York Philharmonic under Arturo Toscanini. In 1959, Gunther Schuller resigned his solo horn position to devote full-time to composition. He's received commissions from many major orchestras in the United States. He's composed for choreographer George Balanchine of the New York City Ballet, and he's written an opera for the Hamburg State Opera in Germany. Gunther Schuller's long association with a modern jazz quartet has led him to compose works for this group in what is called the third stream idiom, which combines contemporary classical music with improvisational music and jazz.
I was fortunate that I grew up in a totally musical family. My father was for 42 years in the New York Philharmonic, and so when I was a kid, I heard and absorbed music without even knowing it.
And you weren't the kind of kid who was dragged screaming to the piano. It's just something that you picked up.
Well, I tell you, I didn't consciously pursue any kind of musical activity until I was 11. And my father did drag me to the piano at age 9, and I didn't respond. I didn't like it.
He said, "Here, practice."
But what I'm talking about is that all this time I was going to concerts in the New York Philharmonic, the Lewiston Stadium in the summer. The radio was always on with good music. In those days in New York, you had three good music stations. All day long. Records, and my father's practicing, and a house full of music. So that when I started actually thinking, oh, I want to be a musician, I suddenly realized that there were a heck of a lot of things which I already knew, but I didn't know that I knew them. But in thinking about them, I realized I knew them. You know what I mean?
That was a kind of process of osmosis.
Yeah, right. And then it went very quickly, and that's why I became a professional horn player after 2 years after I decided to pick up the horn the very first time. And then it went quickly, and I went to the Cincinnati Symphony and the Metropolitan Opera and all of that. But in the meantime, I was always composing already, and that is still my primary, I think it is my primary gift, and that's the thing that I would like to do if I had my druthers exclusively. But you see, it's not all that easy. For me, I feel that all the wonderful things which I've had the privileged to experience as a composer, as a performer, 15 years in the Metropolitan Opera. I mean, you realize how many fantastic performances I heard there and learned from.
And wrote for. Didn't you write for?
Well, I wrote an opera for the Hamburg Opera, not for the Met. But, and then, yeah, as I say, all the experiences as a composer, as a conductor, as a performer, as a writer on jazz, and all kinds of things, I feel that I want to share those, and I want to translate those, if I can, into an educational philosophy, which I think is embodied in this conservatory, the New England Conservatory. It isn't all mine, but I think a good share of what happens here has been somewhat informed by those experiences. And I can't be one of those people who goes off into his ivory tower and writes his 15th symphony, and that's it. You know, I think there's more that we have to do as musicians. Shouldn't be any kind of imposition on anybody else, but for me, I feel I should be able to write any kind of music that is asked of me, just as, and I don't mean to compare myself to Mozart, but just as a man like Mozart could and would. And if, you know, somebody wanted a piano concerto, you got a piano concerto. If you wanted a mass, you got a mass. If you wanted an opera, you got an opera. I think it's sort of the ideal state of creativity if you can work in all of the media or all the concepts or forms. It's also the most rewarding. However, that's not to say that there aren't brilliant exceptions to that, i.e. Wagner, who was a very bad symphony writer but a great opera composer, you know. And so that's just a personal subjective thing that I said. I like to work in almost any kind of idiom or form. For example, the spokesman for the third stream movement, which is, again, part of that same picture. It's an attempt to say, no, there isn't only this music over here called classical music, 19th century European music, and then over in this corner, in the blue trunks, we have...
and I don't want to touch it.
Jazz, and over here is rock, and here is Indian music, and over here is Oriental music. You know, all these little pigeonholes that we have. I've always believed, and this is already a cliche by now, there's only two kinds of music, it's good and bad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you get into categories, it is no longer a tenable point of view to keep these kind of segregated categories. I have always had the other outlet into jazz. Now, of course, I'm not saying jazz is light music,
because it's not,
and it's, you know, they have this terrible thing where they call classical music serious music, and the implication is that jazz is not serious. Of course, it's very serious, and but that is at least a what is it? It's simply in a different idiom or style or concept.
Is that what your third stream is all about? It's a combination of classical form and jazz.
Yes, that's the simplest way of putting, right? Yeah.
Is there a group at the New England Conservatory you are working with in terms of third stream, if that's the right word?
Well, yes, we're the only institution in the world that has a third stream music department, and it's run by Rand Blake. He's the chairman of it, and we have a smallish enrollment in that, which is growing, by the way. It once it exists, there are many, many people who want to apply for that because there's a need for it, you know. It comes back to that social, historic, musical, artistic problem, philosophical problem, that basically we live in a world of categorizations. And in music, it's just as true as any other place. And for most people, jazz is separated from classical music. And classical music is separated from Greek folk music. And that three shall never meet. Mm. Well, Rand Blake and myself and others like myself, you know, just to say, well, that's nonsense. We have had almost a half a century of very intense experimentation and exploration in music, which has, of course, created the well-known audience problem. I mean, the music has moved so quickly, almost renewing itself year by year, when it used to be decade by decade or century by century. Things that took a century to develop 500 years ago now take 3 years. And we composers can hardly keep up with it, the professionals. So you can imagine the problem for the audience, who's just about caught up with Bartok. And here these guys are going along with Stockhausen and Penderecki and aleatory music, electronic music, computer music, so on it goes. So, but I think we've reached a point where that kind of intense experimentation is for the moment on the wane. I mean, that's not to say that we're not looking further or experimenting or exploring, but the idea that we must explore at all costs, I think, is a little bit in disfavor at the moment. And what's happening, it's all part of this, maybe this nostalgia thing that's going on. We're all looking a little bit back and we're saying, hey, wait a minute, let's look at all that again. Mm-hmm. We passed over that a little too quickly. We didn't really digest it yet. Let's look at what happened in 1940 or 1950 and let's go over that again and let's see what more there is to find within that concept rather than to find a whole new concept. And Third Stream fits into that in the sense that this is one of the many things that is still out there on the front lines that we're looking at more thoroughly. I know there are some people who, hearing me say this, would say, oh my God, I thought that was dead 10 years ago. Well, I got news for them, it isn't. It is not in the news every day. It's not a headline in Time magazine as it was 10 years ago. But for many composers, it still is one of the real concerns that they preoccupy themselves with, just as it is for many composers still to explore further the extensions of 12-tone music, or as it is for other composers to look at the further technological advances possible in the electronic media, or as it is for others to say, hey, wait a minute, I like all of those three things, third stream, 12-tone, and electronic. And who's to say nay? The only final answer and arbiter is won by a great genius artist who says, here's the product. I don't care what you think, how I arrived at it, here it is. And the world says, yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
there is something in a composer or any creative person that makes him recognize that for the moment he has exhausted all the possible options or alternatives of a given decision. And by the way, that process happens at every split second of a composition. Every note I put down, what's really happening is that I'm deciding that's the best I can do at that moment. And I've considered all the other options. Instead of F sharp, could it be G sharp? Instead of a half note, can it be a whole note?
It must take you forever.
All these styles, now, after a while, of course, you do those so quickly and so kind of second nature intuitively. It's a combination of the brain and the heart and the soul and everything working together. So it goes very quickly. But these are instantaneous decisions, and you put them all together in a sequence and you have a composition. Now, what distinguishes a composer, a creative person, or this would apply to a painter or to a writer, from others who aren't really composers, is in addition to the talent, whatever that may be and at whatever level, there is that sort of mechanism where you know for the moment, by the way, that's subject to review by posterity, by yourself, you may change. 10 years later, you may say, how did I ever write that? That's stupid. But for the moment, you say, that's it. And I can't explain it any more than that, because it's a rather mysterious event that happens at that moment. I mean, we can't rationally explain that or in any kind of physical way. But that's what makes a composer, that he knows that. And he goes on to the next note. And we put them all down. He says, that's it for the moment. Now, that doesn't prevent someone, Boulez is famous for this. He's written pieces and then 5 years later totally revised them or even abandoned them. So we're all different. But I'm not a revisionist. I can't work on a piece and then, as I say, do my best to write it as best as I can at that moment, and then leave doubt in my mind. See, gee, was that really right? And shouldn't I revise it? Because as you already said, you might go on for years doing that, and some composers do that, and sometimes it's good that they do that. But what I would rather do is to do my best, finish it, and whatever faults I then see or others see that I accept, then I do better in the next piece, rather than constantly revising the first piece. Because in a way, if you push that to the ultimate consequence, then you only write one piece in your life.
And you get constantly totally dried out.
And you constantly revise it, and you never finish it. I don't know.
Do you work at a piano when you compose, or do you just write silently?
No, I write really without the piano, although sometimes I sit at it and kind of piddle around on it. I don't play the piano.
Oh, you
and
don't?
I don't play the piano at all. And in fact, the things I write, not only can I not play them, but nobody can play them at the piano, because, I write in an orchestral piece, I write for the orchestra. Now, if you're writing for the contrabassoon and the piccolo and the horns and the violins and the violas, well, you need about 5 hands to play all that. Mm-hmm. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but
I understand.
You can't play. Also, even technically, you get into things that are polyphonic. There may be so many voices that you can't play. So the piano is not. And in fact, there's a danger sometimes that if one does work at the piano, that you start writing things that are pianistically possible and available to you, and then they are piano music and not really orchestral music. Mm-hmm. So I don't write at the piano. Sometimes I think up some things that are so complex that I really have to sit down at the piano and try them out sort of in their components. I still can't hear the totality of it except in my head. It's amazing how for the first time people, and let's say leave it in music now and just say musicians, are waking up to their own American heritage, which includes things that they haven't seen before. If you stopped a musician on the street 4 years ago and said, "Who's Scott Joplin?" They say, "What?" And they say, "Oh, that's something to eat." Now they know who Scott Joplin is. We've awakened to the wonderful truth that Scott Joplin was not only a composer, or not only a black composer, but a very great composer. Now, there's many other Scott Joplins in our historical closets that we're just beginning to discover again under the impetus of the bicentennial. Everybody's inventing bicentennial projects. And suddenly, we're coming back to the music of America of the late 19th century, which everyone has swept under the rug until now. I say, well, no, I want to listen to Beethoven. I don't want to listen to John Knowles Payne. Well, it so happens that John Knowles Payne wrote the best Beethoven symphonies other than Beethoven.
Oh, really?
Yes, he
I didn't know that.
He adored Beethoven, and he wrote two symphonies. And the worst thing you can say about them is they are imitative of Beethoven. But by God, they're marvelously made symphonies. So I'm not saying that they're going to displace the Eroica, but I do say that they ought to be heard at least once in a while, and they ought to be performed. And they are at least as good as a lot of things that we keep importing from Europe. And we have the imprimatur of the European pedigree on it immediately. And therefore, it's automatically better than the homegrown product. Well, we're finally coming to our senses, or at least I hope we are. We're coming more to our senses about that. And the bicentennial is contributing to that. And then it is also, the third element is what I already said, this sort of backlash from all of this headlong experimentation all the time. And people finally get tired. Even composers are tired. They say, gee, well, let's rest a little bit. Let's see what we've got. Here we've invented all of these 105 new concepts. And you say to yourself, well, are they really all valid? Let's look at them again. Which are really enduring? Which can produce something for the future? And in that reassessment, things will be dropped. Others will be reinforced and emphasized, and others we will say, yes, that's wonderful, but you know, there was something that happened 20 years before that which led to that, and let's look at that again. You know, and this is happening. It's happening in jazz, it's happening in popular music, it's happening in the so-called classical music. It's happening all over.
Is Ragtime your bicentennial project, do you think? Is the conservatory going to take on a particular bicentennial project?
Oh, no, we're going to take out many bicentennial.
Many, many.
Yes. I mean, one thing that I'm very much involved in is bringing a major contemporary music festival here to Boston. This is something to do with the what's called the ISCM, which is the International Society of Contemporary Music, which is a organization, worldwide organization, devoted to contemporary music, founded in 1923, I think, in Europe. Well, they have an annual festival. This annual festival in all these, what's 23 to, where are we, 75?
75.
What is that, 52 years? Mm. Yes, in 52 years, it's never been held in the United States. And I've moved a lot of things around to get it here to Boston for 76. And the conservatory will be involved with that. We're not sponsoring it ourselves, but we will be very heavily involved with that. Certainly we'll do Ragtime, certainly we'll do either programs or festival of music having to do with our musical heritage going back to colonial times. So we'll do a lot of
things. So this is what the
president... We want to, I tell you, to put in one sentence, what we want to do is to celebrate in, let's say, the last 20, 30 years, the maturation of the American musical culture, where we no longer have to say, Europe is better. You got to go to Europe to study. The European composers are the best. The European orchestras are the best. All of that was true 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. It is not at all true anymore. In fact, I've often suggested that we rewrite the Fulbright program so that people in Europe can come to America to study on the Fulbright program, because the whole thing has reversed in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. So what I hope that most people will do in the bicentennial, insofar as music is involved, is to celebrate our own maturity as a musical nation. Because we've far too long had an inferiority complex about ourselves. And anything that comes from Europe gets the red carpet treatment right away. And I don't say that in a sort of dumb, chauvinistic sense. I just really am very proud of what is happening here, what has happened here. I mean, the proliferation of musical culture in this country in the last 10 years, or let's say 2 decades. And by proliferation of music culture, I mean all kinds of performing organizations, whether they're symphony orchestras or jazz or who knows what. I mean also educational institutions related to music. I mean also our whole awareness of the importance of musical culture, the support that that music gets. It's still not enough, of course, and compared to other countries, it's insufficient. But all of that has happened in has been such a proliferation that I would say absolutely categorically it's unprecedented in the entire history of the world. And you know, where 30, 40 years ago in this country we had maybe 10 orchestras that are worth dignifying with the word, with the name orchestra, we now have dozens or perhaps hundreds that are very marvelous orchestras, and I include the regional and community orchestras. I mean, I just had a performance with the Hudson Valley Philharmonic in Poughkeepsie. Now, you know, Poughkeepsie is not on the musical map, no, like New York or Cleveland or Chicago or something, with Sir George Salty. They played a very difficult new piece of mine in virtually 2 rehearsals, and I can vouch for the fact, being the composer and knowing the piece a little bit, that it was a superb and excellent performance. Now, go back 20, 30 years, and such a thing is absolutely unthinkable. I don't think the New York Philharmonic 20 years ago could have played my piece as well as these young people did, so not all young people, but this young orchestra did a week ago. Well, that's just one example. There are hundreds of such orchestras, and there are hundreds of good schools, and there's hundreds of this and hundreds of that, and that all added together means that we've developed a very strong musical culture and musical awareness. When I was a kid, if you wanted to go into music, you were automatically a sissy if you were a boy. That is less the case now. It still happens in some backward areas, but you know, all of these things have changed. I don't mean, listen, I sound like some raving optimist. You know,
I think it's marvelous.
I don't think that everything is perfect and that, you know, but I'm talking about progress, and I'm talking about a relative view of this, you know. I'm talking about a perspective. And in that sense, what has happened in this country is, as I say, unprecedented. It has never happened before, and we should be at least proud of that. The instrumental virtuosity and ability of the young players today is analogous to what I was talking about, the proliferation. That's much higher than it was 20 years ago. I mean, these kids that can play things on the horn that I couldn't play after I'd been a professional for 10 years.
Mm, that's wonderful.
You know, that's all just part of learning. Humanity, everybody learns from the previous generation.
Thank you for being with us today. We've been talking with Gunther Schuller, musician, conductor, composer, and president of the New England Conservatory of Music. For Pantechnicon, this is Eleanor Stout.
And Robert J. Lertzema. Pantechnicon is produced for WGBH Radio by Greg Fitzgerald. This is the Eastern Public Radio Network.